everyone. Welcome to Undivided. Thank you for being here. Thank you for your commitment to giving common sense a comeback. I'm Brandi Cruz. Whew, we're all in a tizzy before the show started today because I've been busy fighting people on Twitter. I've been busy fighting for sanity. It is a thankless task, and we're going to talk about it, some of it on the show today. We're going to start the show with the news that there will be no criminal investigation into the text messages from a dozen or so prominent Seattle City leaders during the Summer of Love that just poof, vanished. There's not going to be a criminal investigation and therefore no criminal charges into that. That is a pretty significant announcement. So we'll talk about why. Also, an unbelievable defense of the indefensible. We have talked several times on the show in the past couple weeks about this study that showed widespread meth and fentanyl contamination on public transportation. Our elected quote unquote leaders will try to defend just about anything, and this is one of them. And also the homeless industrial complex at work. You may recall on the show yesterday, we talked about how it cost Governor Jay Inslee and his Right Away program more than $1 million per person to get them out of homelessness. He's saying those numbers are a lie. So we will discuss and give the governor an opportunity. He spoke to our friend Jonathan Cho to explain his side of things. All of that and much more coming up, including introducing a brand new show sponsor, jam-packed show on this Wednesday. But first, if you have not become an Undivided subscriber already, please do so. Help support our mission and our movement to give common sense a comeback. UndividedPod.com. UndividedPod.com. Just $5 a month. All right, let's start with the case of the missing text messages. This has been a prolonged saga in the city of Seattle. So a little background for those of you who aren't familiar. We had something called, I think it was Chaz first, and then it was CHOP, Capitol Hill Autonomous Zone, and they turned it into the Capitol Hill Organized Protest. And it was this month-long occupation of six square blocks of the city of Seattle that included the East Police Precinct. And this was a huge ordeal for the city. And, you know, there were a lot of questions about why they abandoned the precinct. They said they weren't going to, and then they backed up moving trucks to the thing and were taking plaques off the walls. And of course, the media wanted to try to get a better picture after CHOP finally ended about what exactly happened here. How did the city bow to these activists and these anarchists and give up a police precinct for 30 days? And so naturally, a lot of journalists did their job by trying to request records via public disclosure to say, hey, let's look at the chief at the time, the mayor at the time, the command staff, let's see their text messages and their emails, et cetera, and get to the bottom of why these decisions were made. But then we found out, and it slowly trickled out over time. At first, it was then Mayor Jenny Durkin's text messages for that period of time were missing. And it was like, oh, Chief Carmen Best's text messages for that period of time are missing. And it was like, oh, so is the Seattle Fire Chief's text messages. Oh, so are all the pertinent members of the Seattle Police Department's command staff. This is starting to seem awfully suspicious. And I think that when something like that happens, when it was just Mayor Durkin's messages, you know, I was like, okay, and I interviewed her multiple times about this. You know, she still sat down with me weekly for interviews at the time, and I'd asked her many, many questions about what happened to the text messages, and she had basically chalked it up to my phone was set to delete messages every 30 days, you know, said it wasn't intentional. And when it was just her, I was sort of like, okay, you know, I can buy it happening to one person, and then it was like a dozen, and of course, that just seems really implausible, but we've never really got a good answer as to what happened. And now we're finding out that we truly may never get a good answer as to what happened. So the King County prosecutor, Lisa Mannion, has decided that they're not going to pursue a full-blown criminal investigation into those missing text messages, simply saying that there's just not enough evidence there to prove ill intent. The headline from the Seattle Times, no charges over former Seattle Mayor Durkin's deleted texts, prosecutors say. From the Times, they write, Mannion said King County Sheriff's Office investigators were, quote, not able to develop sufficient evidence to justify a criminal investigation that would involve in-person interviews and the pursuit of additional evidence. Dan Clark, a chief criminal deputy, said the office concluded Durkin, former police chief Carmen Best, Chief Harold Scoggins, and a number of other city and police employees were working under a, quote, reasonable but mistaken belief that the city of Seattle stored copies of text messages in the virtual cloud as it does with emails. So before I get into, you know, my thoughts on all of this, there was a statement sent out from Steve Fogg. He is representing a dozen people who were involved or kind of accused of maybe intentionally doing this, including Mayor Durkan, Chief Best, Chief Scoggins, and nine others. They sent out a statement yesterday. I'm going to read that statement for you in full. This outcome underscores what has been obvious all along. None of the numerous city workers swept up in this investigation did anything improper. The outcome was never in doubt. So first, let me address that. The outcome hasn't been obvious all along. I would argue quite the contrary. When you have that many high-level city employees, elected leaders, whose text messages for the same period of time, a very consequential period of time in our city's history, just vanish, no, the outcome of the investigation has not been obvious all along. So I do take issue with that. And the investigation did not determine that nothing improper happened. It determined that there's not substantial evidence that something improper happened to warrant a criminal investigation. So just to point that out, his statement goes on to read, to the contrary, at a time of unprecedented challenges, the pandemic, an economic crisis, and civic upheaval, the city's top officials worked around the clock to meet the needs of Seattleites. Because of this work, Seattle led the nation in its pandemic response, resulting in the lowest incident of disease, hospitalization, and death from COVID, and model programs in supporting small businesses, workers, and BIPOC communities. It is disheartening to see that despite their hard work and contributions during those challenging times, they have been subject to years of unfounded accusations that they improperly destroyed public records. The truth was far more pedestrian. The city's IT systems were not properly storing all records. The Durkan administration changed all that by launching initiatives to increase transparency, moving Seattle IT into the future. Now the city enjoys robust protections. We should thank them for their public service and close this chapter. It is time to move on. Now, there's a couple things I agree with there. It is time to move on. I mean, certainly, I think that there's a lot of elements of Chaz Chop that continue to be relevant in the city and speak to the political cowardice in the city. But I just don't, first of all, I'm not in a position to say for sure, obviously, whether they intentionally all coordinated to delete their messages or not. And the investigation doesn't really give me the answers that I was looking for. As a journalist, it's my job to be skeptical. And so when you have something that just seems that blatant, of course I'm going to be skeptical of it. And I think people are right to be skeptical of it. Mayor Jenny Durkan, and we've remained in contact since she left the mayor's office. And I've asked her directly about the missing text messages. You know, she was a former United States attorney for the Western District of Washington. And so certainly she knows the importance of maintaining records, et cetera. So even if there was no malintent criminal wrongdoing, what happened is not only incredibly unfortunate, but also leaves us with this glaring gap in information as to everything that truly transpired around this pivotal moment in the city of Seattle in the summer of 2020. So that's how I leave all this, is being disappointed that I truly don't think that we'll ever have a complete picture of all the failures that led to this. I'm not saying it was intentional, because I can offer my opinion, but I can't sit here and tell you they did this intentionally, because I don't know. There's not going to be a prolonged criminal investigation into it. However, I do hope, as this statement said, that there are protections in place to make sure that even if in the future you have an elected leader who's like, delete those messages, that there is a backup and it's stored. So one individual could not decide to hide just by their own power pertinent information that the public is entitled to. So anyway, CHOP is the gift that keeps on giving, isn't it? Oh my gosh. It's just been fascinating. I thought it was really interesting because I had no wind that this news was going to come out yesterday, which is sort of odd because usually I hear like rumblings of things. And then I got this email from this Steve Fogg and some other individuals saying, hey, you've probably heard what's about to happen. Here's a statement. I'm like, I haven't heard anything. And then they announced that there's not going to be a criminal probe. And there's a lot of people who do my job who have been very forceful that they think the messages were deleted intentionally, and they think this is politicians circling the bases around fellow Democrats and letting them get off the hook. And, you know, again, I still have my skepticism. However, I just don't know. I don't know what happened. I wasn't there. I wasn't behind the scenes. I can say personally, you know, that was like a life-changing period of time for me, Chaz Chop. I mean, my crew getting mobbed up there, virtually no city leaders coming to our defense, calling, you know, a summer of love and all of that. And, you know, that was one of the things that really made me incredibly disillusioned with the state of the media and, you know, and acting like a lot of this was peaceful when it wasn't, and incredibly, incredibly disgusted by the state of politics in Seattle and how they wouldn't condemn what was happening up there, no matter what transpired. And that really led to one of the several reasons for my departure from my job in mainstream news. So, Chaz Chopman, that is a month that we shall not soon forget. All right, coming up next. So we talked on the show yesterday, and I went through the numbers from the State Commerce Department about just how much it is costing taxpayers to remove individuals from homeless encampments on state property. And I said that if you crunch the numbers, we're talking about more than $1 million per person to get them exited from the homeless system. Well, our friend Jonathan Cho talked to the governor about it yesterday, came up to him at an encampment. And the governor says that I'm a liar, essentially. So we'll have those clips for you coming up next. But first, we've been talking about our friends at Firstmark Insurance, firstmarkinsurance.com. Mike and I took the Firstmark Challenge back in the spring. We really encourage you to do it as well. It's a no-brainer. It's free to do. At the very least, you're going to learn a ton about the insurance that you currently have. And they might come back to you and say, actually, you could get better insurance and you could be saving money. They do it all for free for you. Dave Taylor is the CEO of Firstmark. He talked about the purpose of the Firstmark Challenge.
We believe and we say that we will help 100% of the people that we work with. Okay. Now that doesn't mean necessarily that 100% of the people we work with are going to become Firstmark clients, but we believe that we will actually help 100% of the people, whether that be stay with your current carrier, but let's modify your coverage a bit so you're better protected, or ultimately, hopefully come over to Firstmark. We're going to put you with a different company and give you better coverage, right? So the challenge is really challenging individuals to give us an opportunity to prove that to them. That's really what the Firstmark Challenge is.
Yeah, and at this time when so many of us need to be looking for ways to cut back on our budgets and save money, everyone needs insurance. So if you could get even better insurance than you already have through a local company with exceptional customer service, why would you not try it? So take the Firstmark Challenge, firstmarkinsurance.com, firstmarkinsurance.com. They work for you. Somebody on the live chat already said, I said circling the bases again. Ugh, circling the wagons. We need to have like a little montage of all my failed metaphors. Okay. All right. This is what I've been spending. There's two stories I've been spending a lot of time fighting for our honor, you know, on Twitter today, which sometimes I get in these little Twitter feuds and I love it and sometimes I hate it. But today I was all in. You can ask Nicole. I was over here like, anyway. So yesterday on the show, we talked about, Governor Jay Inslee started this right-of-way camp removal program. So we had all these camps along public right-of-ways, interstates, that were on state property. So it could be smack dab in the middle of Seattle, but Seattle's like, we can't do anything. That's not our land. And so they'd be at the whim of the state. So the governor is all of a sudden in his 11th year in our office started to pretend he cares about the homeless crisis and visiting encampments for photo opportunities and stuff. But anyway, so I pointed out, because he was saying last week that they need more money to continue this program. And I was like, wait a second. That can't be right. I said, it's already been allocated $143 million. It hasn't been going on for that long. And I know that it hasn't resulted in a lot of camp cleanup. So how can you actually need more money and how can you justify that? And I looked at the data, the numbers provided by the State Commerce Department. This is their data. And I thanked them yesterday for the transparency in showing how much money has been allocated and what the results are, because I think that we should have that with all government programs like this. So I want to go over the numbers I talked about yesterday, just as a reminder, because Governor Jay Inslee is going to call me a liar. And so I want to go through the statistics. So I had noted, again, by the state's own statistics, that they have allocated $143 million to this program. And the governor says they're about to run out of money. So that tells me they've burned through it all already, right? So I said, depending on what you believe is a determination, what would determine whether it was a success. I offered three different statistics. So if you think a successful outcome is they just clear someone out of an encampment that's on a state right-of-way, okay? That I said, then if you divide 143 million by the number of people they've cleared out of state encampments, regardless of what happens to that person, it's about $110,000 a person just to move them out of an encampment and God knows where they go. So now if you have a higher threshold for what success is, and you think that in order for it to be a success, a person doesn't just have to be moved out of an encampment, but they actually have to accept some sort of housing, even if it's emergency shelter, then I said, okay, so we'll divide the number who have actually accepted shelter out of one of those sweeps by 143 million, 143 million divided by the number, and it's 164,000, which again is a little ridiculous, that it's costing $164,000 per person to get them out of an encampment into even an emergency shelter. And then I gave a statistic for what I believe is a measure of success. To me, that program is only a success if you can get someone out of an encampment and then help them through the system so they're not homeless anymore, so that they're now out of the homeless industrial complex cog. And so I said there's only been 126 people that the state right-of-way program has successfully helped exit homelessness. 143 million divided by 126 is $1,137,000 per person. Per person. And that statistic in this graphic just went gangbusters viral on social media yesterday. So anyway, our friend Jonathan Cho had called me after the show. He said, hey, I just saw that information. We've been crunching those numbers as well. And in fact, I'm going to go ask the governor about it because he's going to be at one of these homeless encampments, you know, touting this program and touting that we need more money. So I'm going to play two different clips from, God bless Jonathan Cho. I'm going to play two different clips from Jonathan Cho's interaction with the governor. The first one, you can tell, like, the governor does not want to talk to Jonathan Cho and his staff, and they're all like trying to ignore his question. And then the governor proceeds to use some of the workers who are clearing these encampments as props to make a political point. So watch.
By your estimation, you'd spend $135 million on this right-of-way initiative, but the Commerce website says that only 126 exits have happened. How do you justify that price tag? How do you justify that price tag, Governor?
I want to tell you something, that last question. How do I justify the fact that we're making an investment to clean up these encampments? I'll tell you how I justify it. These people are working their fannies off. And they're doing great work, and they got families at home, and every single one of them like to eat, and they like to pay their rent, and we need to pay them, and we don't expect them to do it for free. They're hard-working people, but I pay them, and that work is making this a better state, and you're working hard, too. This is hard work. You're out in the heat, you're wearing hazmat suits, and you're getting the job done, and you're helping people. It's not just about removing people from encampment. You're helping people. You're changing people's lives. I know the people. They've told me you've saved their lives. I met a guy down in Vancouver. He said, look, this tiny home village, it saved my life. I was on drugs. It was going to kill me. So you got to be proud of your work. I'm proud of your work. Keep it up. And I hope we can keep funding your work.
Okay. A few things. I'm trying to be undivided here. Undivided. So I'll just point out that he says it's hard work and I pay them. No, you don't pay them. Taxpayers pay them. I want to point that out. But I agree with a lot of what the governor said. I'm going to put aside what I think the intention is there and whether I think he's being genuine or not. I agree. I think those people are doing very, very difficult work. And a lot of the individuals who work in those roles, going out to these encampments, trying to connect people to services, a lot of them are previously homeless themselves. And I would never undercut the job that they're doing. That's difficult. I don't want to do a job where I'm going out to homeless encampments and cleaning them up and trying to contact people who might be in the throes of an addiction crisis or a mental health crisis. 100%. I absolutely agree with the governor's sentiment. No, they shouldn't be doing the work for free. Of course, we should be paying them. Of course, they also have mouths to feed at home. Nobody is arguing that people who are doing this work don't deserve a paycheck. Of course they do. But what we're talking about is whether we can pay people to do that work without it costing $1.1 million per person to get them out of homelessness. And so what you're offering there is a complete straw man, Governor. So that's a little ridiculous. And you're using this emotional pull. You're using the emotions of these people who are doing difficult work to justify the spend of $1.1 million per person to get them out of homelessness. You know, I've been out with Andrea Suarez of We Heart Seattle, which is a citizen-led nonprofit that has a lot of volunteers that do their work, and they're able to get people out of homelessness for a minuscule fraction of what it takes the government. And so you can pay people to do the work, you can support them in doing that work, you can acknowledge it's difficult, but that doesn't excuse what we're talking about right here. So the second clip is where the governor accuses me of completely manufacturing this number. And again, you can tell that he really does not want to be talking to Jonathan Cho, who's asking him legitimate questions, again, based on data from the Department of Commerce. When I put out this link yesterday, I put the link to the data. I'm not hiding anything. They put it in a very easy to understand way. And so Jonathan Cho is confronting the governor with data from the Department of Commerce. Here's how that went.
Keep it up. We'll see you guys later.
Thank you. Governor, the other part of the question was that's more than $1 million for each one of these successful exits.
That's false. Don't repeat that because it's false.
That's the numbers according to Commerce's website. Is that justified?
You're just wrong. We've had 800 people get housing.
But according to Commerce's website, it says 126 successful exits. That's more than $1 million per successful exit.
Thank you.
That's according to Commerce's website that I'm looking at, sir. I just wanted to know if you can help me explain what that number means.
When you build an apartment, it's not just for one person. It's around for 50 years. So that seems like a big number. When you have to build an apartment that costs $1 million, it's good for 50 years. So that number that seems big to you is not big when you realize you have to build a building. It's going to serve hundreds of people. Maybe it only served 100 now, but it's going to serve 1,000 over 50 years. That's the reason.
Okay.
So first of all, when he says, don't repeat that, it's not true. We didn't just go out and say it cost $1.1 million to get one person out of homelessness. We offered you three different numbers depending on what your measure of success was. And we explained in detail how we came to those figures using Department of Commerce data. And so let's just for you know what's and giggles, because I can't say the S word on the show anymore. Let's throw the governor a bone. And let's redo the math based on what he's saying there. And it's also the Department of Commerce talked to us about this in an email. So what the Department of Commerce said is when you're looking at all the money that's been allocated to this program, $143 million, they said a chunk of that is for capital costs. So building buildings, for instance, for people to live in, actual structures. And they said that should at least be amortized over a 30-year period. And look, I think that's fair. I think that's reasonable. I think reasonable people can disagree on this point. I'll talk more about why I prefer to calculate it in a different way afterwards. But let's throw the governor a bone and let's remove the capital costs from the equation. Okay, so I'm going to show you a new graphic I made. So again, $143 million for the program. What we're going to do is we're going to be generous and we're going to look at the most generous interpretation of the data. Let's subtract $60,000. Nicole, do you have this? Mm-hmm. Let's subtract $60,000 in capital costs. So take that completely out of the equation and say, okay, yeah, let's say that you've got a building that's going to be up for 30 years. Unfair to attribute that to the cost right now. You're left with $83,294,000 that they've spent in non-capital costs. So let's divide that by 126. Let's divide that by the number of people that this program has successfully moved out of homelessness, which I believe is the measure of success. Even in the most generous interpretation of the state's own data, that is costing $661,000 per person to move them out of homelessness. Is that success? Even in the most generous reading, giving the governor what he wants, taking out capital costs, the benefit of the doubt, $661,000. There is no interpretation of the state's own data, none, and I would challenge anyone to find a way to interpret it in a way that does not have to end with a serious conversation about government waste, government fraud, because I really feel like that's what the homeless industrial complex is, and government incompetence. So whether you want to go with the governor's interpretation of the data or my interpretation of the data, we are still talking about anywhere between $660,000 and $1.2 million to move a single person out of homelessness. I challenge anyone to tell me that that is a good use of taxpayer funds. Because you can't. And the private sector could do it for a fraction of that. And I'm not saying, I said on the show yesterday, I'm not saying that it's not going to cost money to get us out of this crisis. We have to spend money, unfortunately, because it has gotten so bad. But there is no way anyone can convince me that that means $660,000 to $1.2 million per person to get them out of homelessness. You might as well buy them a house at that point. But of course, buying someone a house will not get them out of homelessness because they'll still either be addicted to drugs or mentally ill or both. So the governor can say, don't repeat that. That's a lie. Okay, we'll stop saying that number and we'll use $660,000 and we'll see how people feel about that. Ridiculous. It's absolutely ridiculous. So anyway, I'm surprised the governor's office didn't message us and say, stop using that number. And they just told Jonathan Cho that it's a lie. And I just wanted to explain quickly why I chose to include the capital costs in my interpretation. And it's because the Commerce Department data at this point does not explain. So you've got the capital costs. Let's say you built an apartment. The Commerce Department data at this point doesn't say how many of those 126 people moved into a building that was built with those specific capital costs. And until we know that, it's impossible to know how many of those capital costs have actually been used to help the people who have been cleared from homeless encampments. And the governor says, well, you could have 1,000 people live there over the next 30 to 50 years. You could, or you might not. How many homeless hotels are sitting empty or have never even been used? So yeah, if you build a freaking building with $10 million and nobody's in it, you better bet that I'm going to lump that in with the cost associated with helping 126 people. So that's why I use the capital costs. And now if I lump the capital costs in now, we would expect them to need less money down the road, right? If they're saying we're running out of money, well, then surely you won't need another $143 million, because if we're taking out the $60 million in capital costs, those investments have already manifested. You've already built things, and you don't need to build more things, right? So it's all just ridiculous. It's complete government incompetence. It's insane to me that we allow and we're comfortable with the government operating this way. And I've said a million times, having a father who died homeless, the least compassionate thing that we can do is not to want to account for every dollar of that money. If you give a heck about the homeless, if you care about them at all, then you should be demanding to know where every cent is being spent. I don't understand the progressives and the leftists who are so opposed to accountability for the hundreds of millions of dollars spent on the homelessness crisis. Aren't you curious why we've spent billions of dollars and our homeless crisis is worse? Aren't you mad if that money is not going to help the people who are suffering actually better their lives? Aren't you mad if that money is going to bloated government salaries and the red tape of government bureaucracy? You should be pissed. I'm pissed. It's not empathy to let that money go down the drain. Demand better. I don't care if they are of your political ideology, because what they're doing is failing us, the taxpayers, and it's failing the people who are dying in squalor on the streets. And it's shameful for the governor's response to be, you're lying about that data. No, that's the state's data. That's the state's data. If you're not happy with the data, do better. Okay? Do better. All right. Coming up next, it is unreal to me what politicians and their staff will try to defend if it means trying to prove me wrong, just in the name of trying to disagree with me. The things that they will defend. Unbelievable. So we'll get to it next in our segment, Unbelievable. But first, we've been talking about our friend, Wes Jones, a wonderful real estate agent in our area. You know, he and I were just chatting the other day about how people continue to move out of state. However, there are still people looking to buy in state. And so they're always going to need houses. And Susan, a friend of ours, and was also a listener of Dory's show, who used Wes Jones and Associates when she went to sell her house for 25 years, she just spoke so highly of them and their Listing Boost concierge service, which allowed her to basically just step away. They came in, fixed things that needed to be fixed in her house, paid for it up front, and she had tremendous results.
I knew I had to paint. I knew I needed to get new flooring. I needed to get new lighting. I told him up front that I was very interested, that I did not have the time or the finances to do what needed to be done. And he immediately jumped in with, well, I do. Work started immediately. And I would say in 2 to 3 weeks, they had landscaping done. They had all the painting done. The new floors were put in. All the lighting was put in. It just was all so fast. And the rest is history. It was on the market for 7 days. I was able to get well over listing price.
To be specific, Susan got 20 offers, sold it for 15% over list price, and ended up getting $200,000 more than an investor offered her before the renovations. Yeah, which is awesome. Just by making one phone call to Wes Jones. So check it out, sellwithwest.com, sellwithwest.com. If you're in the market to sell your home, just start by using their listing or their home value calculator on their website. You can just plug in your home, see how much your home might be worth. It could be worth more than you think. Sellwithwest.com, a better way to sell your home. I saw some people correcting me in the live chat. 60 million, what did I say? They said it's 60 million, you mean. $60 million, did I say like 60 billion or something?
I don't know. I missed it.
60,000.
They must Somebody have caught it, and I didn't.
They must have caught it. Good job, Nicole. Way to pay attention. Yeah. Hey, you want to show people your hair on the live 60, chat today?
Oh, is it that?
It looks great. I love it. It's all
it's
what do you call
beach
that?
Wave. It's like crimped, but crimpy. Like beach wave do.
I love it.
Thanks. All right. Should I wear it like this for the wedding?
You can. Will you work on a graphic of Oh, I told Matt Gilbert said I said 60,000. 60 million. That's 60 million. I'll have to correct that thing. Will you? Well, I do unbelievable because I have another rant coming on. I'm trying to recover from the last one.
Okay.
So I can get for the next one. Mm-hmm. Will you find that hairstyle that you want to wear for the wedding and put it next to the picture of the hairstyle
so proud.
That I said it looked like? Shoot, it's been so long since I started on the show. I was laughing. I was crying because Nicole was sending me a group text with bridesmaids. And he's like, we're so excited for the wedding. And Nicole was like, and they're like, how are you going to do your hair? And Nicole sent a picture. And I was like,
okay, just come up with a picture.
Okay, we'll do it in comments later.
The picture.
Okay.
She's so proud of herself over this picture.
So funny and humble and just all of those things. All right, I got to get serious now because my unbelievable segment is also serious. So we've been talking about how there was a study done by the UW that found that there is widespread meth and fentanyl contamination on surfaces and in the air on public transit, both when they, you know, swabbing inside buses, swabbing inside trains, and I don't understand how anyone could spin that in a positive light, but apparently some government officials and employees have found a way to do so because they are so eager to disagree with me. Let's get to it in our segment, Unfreaking Believable. Okay, so I'll just revisit the story quick. There was a study done by the University of Washington, and they went to several transit area agencies along Western Washington and also down in Portland, and they collected, you know, samples from seats and steering wheels, and they even collected airborne samples, which I kind of want to know how that works. Like, do you take a little tube and you're just like, you know, and just lock it in there? Anyway, scientists are interesting to me. And their findings were pretty stunning. I wouldn't say surprising, but pretty stunning. They found UW researchers analyzed the findings from 78 air samples and 102 surface samples collected from transit vehicles. Of the 78 air samples, 25% had detectable levels of fentanyl and 100% had detectable levels of meth. Of the 102 surface samples, 46% had detectable fentanyl and 98% had detectable meth. Detection of fentanyl or meth, they noted, does not mean it poses a health risk to operators or the riding public. However, they explicitly said, rightfully so, in this UW study, that they couldn't rule out long-term health implications because they hadn't studied it long enough. You know, they weren't plucking hairs out of drivers who'd been driving for 10 years and seeing if they've got, you know, meth in their system or whatever it was. And so there is certainly information we don't know about the long-term health implications, but they cannot rule out, obviously, this is common sense. If someone's riding a bus to and from work every single day, if they're driving a bus for 40 hours in a work week, you cannot tell me that being exposed both on surfaces and in the air to meth and fentanyl wouldn't have some sort of health implications on them. You can't rule that out, and UW is not ruling it out. So anyway, I pointed out on the show earlier this week how over the weekend, King County Metro spun it in the most positive light they possibly could. They said in their tweet, in a first-of-its-kind study, the UW released an analysis of drug, smoke, and residue samples collected on transit vehicles. Health officials say the levels are, quote, extremely low, and riding transit remains safe. To which I thought, you can't say that it is safe. UW has said they don't know the long-term implications of it. And even if, well, I'll get to that in a moment. What I made the point earlier this week is we've been preached to our entire lives about the impacts of secondhand cigarette smoke. You know, as someone who's never smoked a day in my life, the smell of cigarette smoke sickens me. And I believe everything that we've been told about the negative health implications of secondhand cigarette smoke. And you mean to tell me that secondhand exposure to meth or to fentanyl isn't something we should be deeply concerned about? And we had pointed out that just a few days ago, over in Forks, there was a guy who was arrested and charged with drug endangerment because his 18-month-old was found in a room with meth smoke. John Robinson of Forks, charged in Clallam County Superior Court, were arrested after a child was found in a bedroom filled with what turned out to be meth smoke. And now he's charged with a Class B felony. He could spend 10 years in prison and a $20,000 fine. Rightfully so. Because common sense tells us that being exposed to smoke from an illicit drug, exposed to, you know, surface touching that has residue from an illicit drug, common sense tells us That's not a good thing. We put people in prison for stuff like that when they exposed kids to it. And you don't think that we have parents with kids riding public transit and you want to try to spin the news that, you know, 100% of air samples have meth in it and a lot of them have fentanyl? And so it just seemed very odd to me. Now, it gets even worse because today, why I was fiercely tweeting today, the spokesperson for King County Executive Dow Constantine took issue with the segment I did earlier this week, which I had sent out on X this morning, calling out King County Metro for trying to spin this in some sort of, you know, not so bad light. So he shares my story and he says, if you don't want to add the context of how much was measured, here it is. And then he goes on to go in excruciating detail, includes a little graphic talking about a nanogram per cubic meter is 1/1,000,000th of a gram in a 3-foot cube. At the high end, study found 2.32 nanograms. At the low end, 0.003 nanograms. The smallest grain of sand weighs around 350 nanograms. Chase Gallagher, I don't care. I don't care. Think about this for a second. You have a government official so eager to disagree with me, so eager to dunk on me, that they're going to try to downplay and excuse the widespread detection of illicit drugs on public transportation. And as soon as I said that to him, is why are you wasting your energy? It shouldn't be excused in any amount, at any level. You know what he did? He deleted his tweet. Oh, you don't want to stand by what you said, what you did? Like, I'm sorry, if you entered the ring, you're not going to call me out and not expect some sort of response. And that's all I said is, listen, as the staff of an elected leader, why are you bothering trying to downplay something that is obviously so bad? All I want to hear from King County Metro, all I want to hear from elected leaders is, this is terrible. It's bad that they even had to do the study. There's a reason the study was done. It was because things had gotten so bad. It was because bus drivers and riders complained about the environment and the drug smoke and the toxic nature of what's happening on our buses and trains. There's a reason they had to do the study in the first place. It's bad enough they had to do it. Yet here you are arguing with me the minutiae of how many nanograms per cubic foot were found. I don't give a damn. Meth was detected in 100% of airborne samples. It was detected in a lot, 98% of surface samples. And there was also a lot of fentanyl detected as well. If you really cared about, these are the same people who preach public transportation and yay, people who ride buses and trains and boo, people who ride in their cars. Well, I can tell you what, I'd much rather ride in my car even at 5-something per gallon per gasoline than sit on one of your meth smoke fueled buses or trains. And how much disdain does that show for the people, the hardworking people who drive our buses under incredible circumstances, faced with individuals who pose a risk to them every single day on certain routes. How much disdain does that show for them that you would say, well, it's not that much. How are we just talking nanograms per cubic foot? It's enough for UW to have done a study. And the only thing I want to hear you do is come out and say, this is unacceptable. We want our trains and our buses to be safe, clean places for everyone. And any detection at this level is absolutely unacceptable, and we're going to do better. That's all I want to hear from you, not excuses. The excuses are frankly unbelievable, especially since you're making excuses just because it's something I'm speaking out about, because you're that ideologically driven. Get a freaking grip. Get a grip today. Hi, Nicole.
Wow.
Things are going
fire.
But seriously, do you know what I'm saying? Why are you wasting your energy fighting with me on Twitter? I'm speaking out against meth and fentanyl contamination on public transit. You hate me that much, and you're opposed to me that much, that you're going to find a way to justify that contamination by going into the minutiae of how many nanograms per cubic foot.
Right.
Don't stop. If you want to find excuses, find a different job that doesn't involve looking out for the health and well-being of the public, for the love.
Yeah, no, I agree. I don't get it.
I don't
I don't get it. I guess they just want to prove you wrong on something so that it discredits everything else or something along those lines. I don't know. They just pick something and have to do something with it.
It's just like,
it's wild. But I can't believe he deleted it. If you're going to post that, you leave that up.
Hey, you say you want to walk in the ring?
Yes.
Let's go.
Go for it.
That's ridiculous. There's no answer you could have given to diminish it.
No.
There's none. I don't care how minuscule the amounts. And I know that you can't, I don't think you can actually die from fentanyl on a surface exposure, but we're not talking about death. I'm not saying that somebody has to die from that exposure for it to be a problem. Well, and there was some other leftists on Twitter saying, well, Brandy, do you even know how much meth exposure it takes to kill someone? Again, I don't care. I'm not saying they have to die for it to be bad. No one deserves, who's not using drugs, no one deserves to walk on a bus or a train and be exposed to any extent to an illicit drug that they are not putting in their bodies. That's wrong. And any attempts to diminish it is wrong as well.
Right. And I mean, also pets. I know somebody that has two dogs that died because they ate pills, or they don't even know what they ingested at a park, but they died of a drug overdose on the way home from the park. And all it would take would be a dog licking the seat, right?
Right.
And no, it's not acceptable. It's not acceptable behavior. It's not acceptable for society to be exposed to these things on a regular basis. So that, I mean, you know, my mom drives school bus, and one of her concerns, I mean, you know, my dad has this CBD lotion. My mom is scared to put it on with her hand so that she doesn't test positive in a drug test by accident. Like, it's, I mean, you take all these precautions in your life not to be exposed to things like that, especially when it's, you know, job, you know, detrimental to your job, not to test positive for drugs. And all of these people on a regular basis are being exposed. You don't know how much.
UW says that. You don't know how much.
And these tests might have been minuscule, but like maybe they missed something, and maybe the next time they leave something more. Maybe the next, it's unacceptable to allow people to consume drugs on public transportation.
Right. To sit there and be breathing it in. We've never been accepting. Mm-hmm. We've never been accepting of secondhand exposure to any sort of substance like that, even legal substances like cigarette smoke, like vape. I mean, they talk about all the dangers of all of that. And now all of a sudden you're preaching to us that, oh, it's in such small. Would you ever see the government downplay in any way the exposure to secondhand cigarette smoke? And to have the government come out and say, well, the secondhand cigarette smoke is in such small levels and quantities that it's not a big deal. You would never see that. So why are you doing it with meth and with fentanyl? It's because you cannot do anything. You can't see anything past your own ideology and your own political party and what would be good and bad for them in the headlines. Mm-hmm. That is just sick, sick stuff. And that's the problem with our political system. Anyone with an ounce of common sense, right, left, or center, knows that exposure, no matter the quantity, to an illegal drug isn't a good thing. And here we have politicians in a big segment of the population that's letting them get away with it, downplaying it. That's wrong. And you don't, honestly, you shouldn't have a job in the public sector if that is your mindset. Ridiculous stuff. Truly, truly unbelievable.
Fire. Also, do you want to see the hair side by side?
Okay, wait. Hold on. We'll do it after Eastside Weight Loss Clinic before comments.
Okay. Deal.
Okay. So a wedding's coming up in just a week. Feeling great, feeling amazing. Thanks to Eastside Weight Loss Clinic. I'm so glad I started the program when I did. In fact, it was about this time last year. I started the beginning of November, and I was already down about 30 pounds by the end of the year. And so if you've been hearing the ads and you're thinking, hey, you know, this is something I've been considering, think about it. You could have results like that before the holidays, before you go out with friends and family. And I did Eastside during the holidays last year, even during a trip to Vegas, and I still had fun, still enjoyed my life, didn't feel like I was absolutely miserable on some diet where I can't actually live. So it's a great time to start the program. It's around when I started it as well. The best thing to do is just to schedule a 15-minute consultation with Dr. Ryan Coogan and his team, EastsideWeightLossClinic.com. EastsideWeightLossClinic.com. You can ask them all the questions you want to make sure that it's right for you before you invest in this life-changing endeavor. Man, I'm glad I don't look like I did last year for my wedding. I would be so disappointed. Look, you know, beauty comes in all shapes and sizes. Yes. But for me, I just remember looking at pictures this time last year and being like, oh my God, I'm going to get married in a year. I got to do something about it. Okay, so let's talk wedding before we dive into the questions and comments. And then we're introducing a new show sponsor, which I'm really excited about. So, Nicole, tell me if I'm a bridezilla. So Nicole was sending earlier to our group chat the hairstyle that she wants. And I had told them, you can do anything, just don't wear it down. Because it's kind of windy there sometimes, so do anything. So Nicole sent a photo. Go ahead, Nicole.
Well, it's both.
Yes. So Nicole sent the picture on the left. I sent the picture on the right saying, that's what that reminds me of. It reminds me of, if you're listening on the podcast, you know, what is
Napoleon Dynamite.
Napoleon Dynamite, the girl on Napoleon Dynamite who he has the hots for, mm-hmm. how she wears her ponytail on one side. That reminds me of the hairstyle that you want for the wedding.
Well, first of all, you said no to the group chat.
I said,
and I said, hey, the rule was anything but down.
I said, no, LOL. So anyway, you can wear it. It'll look beautiful on you. I'm just saying that's
says, but I hadn't seen that photo.
Deb. Yeah, photos by Deb. Oh,
I haven't seen it. I thought about that movie in a while, so thank you.
Yeah, that's too funny. Mugshot Espresso says, my eyes. Two Ladies Midwest Adventures says, I'm being a bridezilla. No, I'm not. There's only two things I've said. Miranda can't have her big, you know, Edward Scissorhands nails, yep, which is totally reasonable.
I can't have rings.
No, first of all, you wear a lot of jewelry.
I do.
What
and
is
silver.
Who is the, wow, I'm going to be just harsh on Nicole today.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Who that is the classic beauty who says, look at what you're wearing and then take one thing off? Who is that? Audrey Hepburn?
Sure. That's Elizabeth Taylor, maybe? Or, yeah. But she would add it.
You really, you stack up the bracelets and stuff. And I just said,
not bracelets.
I just said,
like
avoid.
I have old lady hands.
Avoid
I like to make
excess them. Jewelry because mm-hmm. I've got jewelry for you.
Okay.
And that jewelry's gold.
And you said, I don't want to see any silver. Well, you know,
no
that's
silver.
All I have.
And Jasmine's got her engagement ring that's silver. I'm not making her take off her engagement ring.
Yeah, she's
ring.
Like, can I wear my
yes,
ring?
Yes, of course. Anyway, everybody's like, I'm so bored. Stop talking about your wedding. Okay, we'll stop. All right, let's get to questions and comments from the live stream today. Bob Larson says, hello, buddy. I'm saying that to you. He didn't mm-hmm. say that. With regards to the missing emails and texts, as a 37-year police veteran, my wife said, if that was me, they would have fired me or fried me. Fried me. There is no excuse. They all knew. If it happened to one person, okay, it might be plausible that it happened by mistake, but all of them, give me an effing break. Matt Gilbert says, the outcome is obvious when the deck is stacked. Lieutenant Dan says, birds in a feather flop together. Lisa Mannion sounds complicit in not prosecuting Durkin, among others. Rick says, unbelievable that Jenny Durkin and other public officials are not being held accountable for the mysteriously missing text messages. Hogwash. Deletions are seldom permanent. This is why people have lost faith in law and justice and politics. There is zero accountability. They just walk away with their wealth and fat pensions at the public's expense and detriment. On Governor Jay Inslee calling me a liar. I mean, I'm assuming that's who he was talking about in that clip. You're a liar. Country guy says he needs an orchestra in the background while he's gaslighting us. Let's see. Ryan says, Brandy, what in the world is a homeless industrial complex? Ryan, is this your first episode? Homeless industrial complex is the massive ecosystem that the government has created that they dump billions of dollars in to solve the homeless crisis, except the homeless crisis never gets better, and it really just goes to bloated government salaries, to government bureaucracy and red tape. The homeless industrial complex is illustrated perfectly by the governor's right-of-way program that has spent $143 million to get just 126 people out of homelessness. That is the homeless industrial complex at work. All right, Janelle with a $20 super chat. Wow, now we have a sugar daddy and a sugar mama on the show. Just have to say, went and got the $3 gas, signed all the petitions. Guy was really impressed. I knew all about them, all because of Dory and you too, Brandy. Really miss Dory. Oh my gosh, I love that you went and got the gas. In fact, our friends—
And then just spent the $20 she saved on our super chat.
Our friends at Future 42 were sending me pictures, and I meant to include them on the show today, but I'll post them on social. And they were great. I mean, it was cool just to see. I mean, $3.82 still is a lot for gas. I would love to go back. One thing I'd love to go back to the Donald Trump days is the right. price of gasoline. Like, I'll give the man that. But it was cool because it's on the marquee, mm-hmm. and it was, like, nice to just see it. I was like, wow, can you imagine?
Back in the threes.
Back in the threes.
Oh, man.
All right, Matthew Cook with a $10 super chat. Get up out of your chairs, open the window, stick your head out, and yell, I'm mad as hell, and I'm not going to take it anymore. Is that from Howard Beale on the network? I've never seen that movie.
Yeah, Dory used to play that quite a bit.
I love it. Mm-hmm. No, I haven't seen it. All right, speaking of Dory, should we introduce our brand new show sponsor?
Let's do it.
Okay, so if you want to gear up for that,
yep,
Nicole. So we have been really, and I'll just say that one of the things that has made this show possible and made it possible, I'm going to get like hammy and sappy, for you to be here is the fact that so many of Dory's show sponsors came over to support our show Had they not, I would have never been able to hire Nicole. We wouldn't be in a position to be able to do as many shows as we're now doing a week. And so that has been really, really meaningful for us. And so I'm excited that we're going to be adding yet another show sponsor, which is critical to helping us grow this work. So we on the show today want to welcome Bulwark Capital Management and Zach Abraham to the Undivided Podcast family. I had a chance earlier today. Are you going to push the applause? Go ahead, Nicole. Yeah, we love it. And Daryl, by the way, is getting me a boop button, so he's working on that.
Okay, good.
So we're so happy to have them, and I talked to Zach a little bit earlier today about adding them to the show and just what they're all about. So here he is. Zach Abraham, welcome to Undivided.
Thanks for having me. Great to be on.
Well, we're really happy to add Bulwark Capital as a show sponsor. We were talking a little bit before we started, and it means a lot to us to have you support the show. And I think that our viewers and listeners will find value out of what you do, but also just from the bottom of our hearts, it means a lot to us personally. I know you were with Dory Monson for years, and to have some of his show sponsors come over and support us, it really means a lot.
Yeah, no, thank you. And it means a lot to us too. You know, you and I were talking a little bit about this off the air. You know, Dory was such a good friend to me and so intricate and helping us build our business, and to be able to work with partners and people that he believed in still, you know, cause we had a working relationship, but it was really built on a friendship. And, I know you feel the same way. He's missed to this day, and to be able to commune with some of those listeners that we don't talk to anymore just because of Dory's passing, and just, yeah, it means a lot to work with you and obviously, we know philosophically there's alignment as well, which I think is really important these days. So now great to be here and thanks for having us.
Yeah. So just do a quick introduction to Bulwark Capital, because folks are going to be hearing from you, not just in our regular sort of ad reads, but we're going to have you on every Thursday because I think there's that value there, like I said, toward helping our viewers and our listeners prepare for retirement and a slew of other things. So what does Bulwark Capital do in a nutshell?
What we want to do is we want to take more of an institutional hedge fund style of investing to retail investors, because we think the world is going insane. We think that the world is propped up on all kinds of, you know, we know propped up printed money, and you're playing a game that has to end badly. Right now, when it ends, when you hear all these prognosticators financially talking about when it ends, it kind of reminds me of when God's coming back. Nobody knows. Right. But what it does mean is that you need a portfolio that can do two things. It can keep up with inflation and not get you buried. But also, when the inevitability of living and perpetuating an economy on printed money, when that inevitability comes to the fore, you need a portfolio that can stand up against anything, right? Your retirement portfolio is supposed to finance the rest of your life. So therefore, that hedge fund, you know, building portfolios that can make money, keep up with markets, you know, give us the capital appreciation, but still have hedges and protections in place.
All right, Zach Abraham with Bulwark Capital. Welcome to the Undivided Podcast, and we will see you back on the show tomorrow. I have an interesting topic to talk to you about on the show tomorrow. I'm going to be asking for personal advice, and so gear up for those questions. We'll see you back then.
I love it. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, so we're excited to have Bulwark Capital and Zach Abraham not only be sponsors on the show, but also we're going to have him on a reoccurring Thursday segment to talk about some of the financial issues facing the country and the economy and inflation, but also things like one of the topics I've been talking about on the podcast a lot lately is how we can get some of these youth out of this crime wave that they're in. And I really feel like financial literacy is something that is not being taught enough to our young people and that they can really benefit from. And so not only are we going to be having him as a sponsor on the show and talking about some of those really newsworthy topics, but next year we are working with Bulwark to host some free in-person seminars with young people and their parents to teach kids for free about things that they can be doing to help set themselves up at an early age. And I think that it is going to have such a positive impact on society to do some of those things. So I'm so excited about it. I'll also note the reason we're starting the sponsorship with them in the middle of the month is because next week they have a webinar coming up. Dory used to talk about these all the time on the radio, but it's an opportunity for you to learn a little bit about how to set yourself up well for retirement. There's even a Q&A portion. So they will have a 2023 risk management strategy live webinar next Thursday, September 28th, starting at 3 p.m. You can sign up to attend that at knowyourriskradio.com. So yay, we're really excited to add a sponsor. And obviously, you know, we're able to do this show through subscriptions, people who support the show for $5 a month, those always sort of ebb and flow. And so having the sponsors as well to make sure that we can, you know, have a steady income stream coming in, be able to grow the show is so important. And you guys working with our sponsors and doing business with our sponsors is really important as well. Okay, massive bust, a fentanyl bust in Bellingham that happened with a quote-unquote homeless person who I'm having a really hard time believing is actually homeless. Let's get to it in our closing sanity check. All right, Nicole spotted this story out of Bellingham, so going far up north today. And there are, man, I mean, first of all, the insane level of criminal conduct that this man was engaged in is in and of itself a story. But then there's some really sad, sad elements to it. It has to do with dogs, okay? The dogs are fine, right, Nicole? We should just say that up front. There was this movie once about...
As far as I know.
Yeah, there was this movie once about a dog, that one about the dog whose military partner died. It was like not too long ago.
All dog movies make me cry. Yeah,
but in the every trailer for the dog movie, at the end, they said in really fast words, they said, the dog doesn't die. So people would still go to the movie because they knew the dog didn't die. Anyway, so the Whatcom County Sheriff, really off on a tangent today, the Whatcom, I promise I'm not using illegal drugs. It sounds like it sometimes. Maybe I was on a bus earlier, a King County Metro bus.
You're on a wedding high.
That's true. Whatcom County Sheriff's Office, they said about a month ago, this is really interesting. So there was a gang and drug task force that received information that a large-scale drug distribution network was being run from a homeless encampment located on Guide Meridian in the city of Bellingham. So they identify a suspect, 34 years old. He gets pulled over by Oregon State Police during a routine traffic stop. So he's like down in Salem. So again, keep that in mind when they're calling this guy homeless. And I'm kind of like, okay, well, he's in a vehicle. He's down in Oregon. There's some other elements. So they find during this routine traffic stop, 70,000 fentanyl-laced pills, $2,000 cash. Okay? So he gets arrested on state charges for all of that. Later that day, this task force executes a search warrant on a storage unit that he is renting. Again, mm-hmm. quote unquote homeless person. Okay, he's got all this fentanyl, $2,000 cash. He has a car, obviously. He has a storage unit.
In Linwood,
so right?
Not even near where he is or was.
Yeah. And they find 3,000 grams of suspected fentanyl powder, although I should really consult with the King County Executive's Office as to whether that's a dangerous amount, because they are the experts on that topic.
Measurements.
500 grams of suspected fentanyl-laced pills, 1,000 grams of suspected heroin, 300 grams of suspected meth, a loaded 9mm handgun, and $46,000 in U.S. currency. The DEA, according to this press release, states that 2 milligrams of fentanyl is considered a potentially lethal dose. So they said that the total amount of suspected fentanyl seized is enough to potentially kill the entire population of Bellingham. And they said that's a conservatively. Detectives believe that all the suspected drugs were destined to be distributed in Bellingham. And then, in addition to the above items, 13 dogs, including 11 puppies, were rescued from the compound and delivered into the care of Whatcom Humane Society.
Right. And there's a bunch of other items that they then went to the homeless camp that he was living at and found a bunch of other items,
they
such
went
as
to,
firearms.
So they served a search warrant at the compound in a homeless camp. How can you have a compound in a homeless camp?
Right.
And they found 4 firearms, including an AR-15, a sawed-off shotgun, a .22 caliber pistol, a 12-gauge shotgun, a small amount of fentanyl, drug packaging material and paraphernalia, and $5,876 in cash.
Which would pay rent somewhere.
And this speaks to something Andrea Suarez with We Heart Seattle, our charity of the year, has been telling us for a long time. When she goes into these encampments, the math doesn't add up. The number of homeless people is not commensurate with the number of tents. And what she has discovered over time is a lot of these tents are used by drug pushers as basically a hub to sell these people the drugs that are killing them, that are keeping them in homelessness and addiction and mental health crises. And so this proves that. This is not a homeless person. And I actually take issue with him being described as a homeless individual. Mm-hmm. This is a drug trafficker who is using the convenience of being set up in part in a homeless camp, because that is where the demand is. So that is where they are going to be. And this is insane. And this is why it's so important to sweep these encampments. you know, people's like, that's not empathetic. You know, you're just moving these people from place to place and they don't have a home. Well, some of them, but some of them are drug pushers who are responsible for killing people on our streets through the narcotics that they push and that they sell. And I'll also note, Whatcom County Humane Society, it might be a good time to offer them a donation, or if you're in the market for a cute little puppy dog.
Oh my gosh, so cute.
We should check with them and see if those dogs are going to be up for adoption, because it just said they were delivered into the care. So,
or sad. Call if you're interested.
Or call. Okay. Nicole's like, I'm not doing that, Brandy. Come on, Nicole. Or call if you're interested. Nicole, apparently that's too much for her today to do to help get puppies a good home. Anyway, I need to end the show because I am way too...
You're a little loopy.
Loopy. Oh,
did you want me to show this gas photo?
Oh, yeah. We got a picture from our friends at Future 42 of the line, and they had it very organized. $3.82 per gallon. Doesn't that look good? Looks terrible compared to the $5.69 per gallon of diesel.
Sorry, diesel didn't get the cut.
Yeah, let us know if you took advantage of that today. So we're happy that some of you were able to make it down there and just get a little taste of what sanity would look like if our elected leaders cared about your wallets, cared about your budgets, which some of them obviously do not. All right, I am clearly a little loopy today, but I'm having a good time. And we're talking about important stuff. That has been today's episode of Undivided. Thank you for being here. Thank you for your commitment to giving common sense a comeback. If you have not supported the show already, help me be loopy for an hour a day on the air. UndividedPod.com. UndividedPod.com. It's just $5 a month. And we are really trying to help right the ship in Washington State. And those of you who subscribe help to support our efforts to do just that. We'll see you back on the live show tomorrow at noon.